Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. I have known a lot of interesting people in my life, and I have read a lot of books by a lot of interesting people. Few of them have entertained me and moved me as much as Rotten Kid, a succulent story of survival by a woman named Bridget Binns. I've been wanting to have her on the air for some time, but she travels too much. So, Bridget, hi, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Rick. It's so wonderful to finally be here with you.
Yes, it's not quite like meeting face-to-face, but it's sort of like that. You have... I'm almost don't even know where to start with you. This book was introduced to me by a mutual friend, Susan Bass, who I will always refer to as Susie Schaller. How do you know Susan? How did we make that connection?
My story. I almost can't remember exactly how it happened, but we had some mutual friends, and it clicked in the most amazing way. She's almost like the Jewish mother I didn't get to have.
You sure didn't have a Jewish mother. I'm going to read Bridget's book. She has written some 30-some cookbook and or food-related books before this. This is a memoir. And you write in here, I'm going to be reading a few things from it, because you're a very, very talented writer. I must admit to never having read any of your cookbooks, because I don't know how to cook. And I think it would be a waste to be wasted on me. You write here at the beginning of the book that your life in particular was paved with embarrassing mistakes and, in earlier years, a crippling lack of self-confidence. There were dangerous pitfalls for which a glaringly privileged Hollywood childhood left me ill-prepared to cope. Many of my friends from that era ended up as movie stars or dead, sometimes both. You feel you were lucky, and you say you escaped by going off to boarding school at age 14.
You
don't want to hear me read your work? It's great work. Some people had claimed to love me, but evidence seemed to prove that they didn't even like me. My simple goal has always been just to carry on, ideally with a sense of humor and a bit of style, but a few rules have always stood fast from beginning to end. Do not look behind the curtain. Do what you must to survive. With this book, Bridget Binns, you pull the curtain apart, don't you? You expose every detail of your life. How hard was that?
Well, you know what, Rick, and thank you so much for your very kind words. I'm blown away.
It's a good book.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. It was a tough write, I have to say. But on the other hand, what's the point if you're not going to open the veins in a memoir? You have no business trying to put it out there into the world. There are lots of people who have wonderful stories. I mean, sometimes I heard somebody say, you don't want to write like the drunk at the wedding that hangs on your arm and says, oh, and then this happened, and it was so interesting.
I've met a lot of people like that. You give some insight near the end of the book. You say, in 2009, I set out to spend a month alone in Marfa, Texas, interesting place, to begin working on the concept of that eventually became this book. After a month, I packed up the notes and diaries into a plastic box. They stayed there for over 10 years. It was only the pandemic that finally pushed me to sit down and resume writing. During that time, I published 10 cookbooks, moved across the country again, and lost my mother. Let's talk about your parents. These are, in a very obvious way, your father, Edward Binns. And if you look up, ladies and gentlemen, if you just Google that name, Edward, last name Binns, after, of course, first buying Bridget's book, you'll recognize him almost immediately. He was a noted actor, was he not, Bridget?
Yeah, he was. He was always either the bad guy or the judge.
Right. And as a father, he was not a great dad, was he?
Well, you know, it took me a long time to figure that out, Rick, yeah. because when I was younger, I saw him as the potential savior and cast my mother in the role of the bad guy.
Which she frankly was, yeah.
Well, she certainly was. But later I realized that he abandoned me with her, and there was nobody to protect me from her. And he had actually already abandoned his first family prior to when I was born. So it took me time to see that he was a wonderful, funny man, a great actor, but not much of a father. And I don't have a lot of resentment toward him. I think I understand his weaknesses from a much more sympathetic place than I might be able to understand my mother's weaknesses, because she hurt me so very profoundly.
She was a monstrous, frankly. You write in here, and if I can read another portion of your book, and again, the title is Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival. This is from the beginning of chapter 4. And it's chilling. It is not a kind of mommy dearest kind of book. I think your book is much more intelligent than that book was. But this is scary here. I'll tell you, Bridget, this is scary. I was 11 years old when Marcia, mom, announced to me that my father was impotent. This, she explained in a giggly, conspiratorial tone, was why she had a, quote, Mr. X, unquote, in her life. Perhaps there was some further reasoning I don't recall. It didn't take long for her to break down and admit his identity. It's your Uncle Pat. My godfather, Uncle Pat, a.k.a. the Gov, a.k.a. Edmund G. Pat Brown, governor of California from 1959 to 1967, father of Governor Jerry Brown. That is an atrocious, frightening, damaging thing to tell an 11-year-old girl. Was it for you?
I didn't know how to process it, to be honest. Yeah. I barely even knew what being impotent meant at that point.
Right.
And I knew that I had my wonderful Uncle Pat, who would take us to lunch and give me a little money on my birthday. And he always used to tell me, never marry a man without a good belly laugh.
That's good advice.
Always a politician. He was a very larger than life person, and they carried on like for 25 years together. And I asked her secretary, who actually was also Brown's family secretary, why did he put up with her constant disdain and the arguments and it was very dramatic. Some of the letters and tapes would really curl your hair.
They do in this book. I mean, one of the you pepper the book with some transcripts of phone calls and letters, and which is a very, very, to my mind, very, very interesting kind of device in here, because it adds a punctuation mark to what you're writing about.
It's interesting, you know, that my editor, my publishers originally didn't want those transcripts in there. And I sort of stood my ground and I said, I think we need to illustrate this. This is not, you know, just some spoiled, white, privileged girl telling stories. These are things that really, truly did happen. And I think it's important. And you are bearing that out for the reader to know what was truly said, what was truly involved.
No, I think it really does punctuate the tales. And you are a fine, stylish writer. All right, let's you know, we got 45 minutes here. Let's go into your life here, young lady. as a kid, your parents split up when you were, I think, I'm trying to remember, 13, and you were off to boarding school after that, yes?
Well, I was always off to boarding school. I mean, my first boarding school out of the 7 schools I attended, 3 of them were boarding schools.
Wow.
The first one was Ojai Valley School up in Ojai, California, which had been my mother's alma mater, and she always wanted me to go there. But sadly, I was expelled after a few months for leading an anti-war demonstration when I was 12.
Good for you. Good. Good. Then you wound up in Sedona for a while. Was there a school in Sedona?
Yes, and thank goodness. I mean, that's what broke the... I was a very troubled kid, and by her calling me, I want to mention the reason the book is called Rotten Kid.
Yes.
Is because that's what she called me all of my life. Well, starting from about the age of 13, she called me that to my face, and she referred to me to her friends and family as a rotten kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think maybe there was a part of her that thought that was cute or funny. She was a big nicknamer, but in some ways, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Oh, of course.
She called me a rotten kid, and I became a rotten kid.
What kind of, you know, what kind of, it certainly wouldn't brew any self-esteem, that's for sure. Wow.
Self-esteem was very thin on the ground at that point.
Yeah.
But going off to my third boarding school in Sedona for the last 2 years of high school, that was a lifesaver because there were important and wonderful people there, and I learned to share. I learned that people could like me, that I was a likable person. I didn't have to constantly be searching for someone who would approve of me.
Yeah.
I found validation there that I had never had before. And, you know, we stay in touch. It was a tiny school, 100 students total. And my inner circle, we still stay in touch to this day, and we go back about every 2 years to Sedona for a little informal reunion, and they're so important to me, these people.
Well, that's such a nice sort of, it's such a nice place to go for any kind of reunion. You write in here, too, and I hate to keep quoting so much from the book, but it's just beautifully written. You write in here, as an only child in the early years, I was intensely lonely and longed for a sibling to deflect my mother's venom. What kind of venom did you feel when you were away from her? Did you feel as if the boarding schools were an escape for you?
They were an escape. They absolutely were, because when I was home alone with her, her vitriol was raining all over me. When I was away in boarding school, her vitriol came in the form of densely written letters full of innuendo and criticism and backhanded compliments that went nowhere. And I could just burn them.
Yeah.
Little did I know that many decades later, I would find carbon copies that she had saved of all of those letters.
Well, you know, and there's nothing like having a nasty, egomaniac narcissist for a mother, that's for sure. Bridget, you write in here, and we'll carry on. I'm going to keep you for most of the show. The first line of chapter one is, I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth and a knife in my back. We will carry on with Bridget Binns. We'll get her out of boarding school. We'll get her to college. We'll get her into a first marriage. This guy is stunningly handsome, this Jeffrey guy you married.
Oh, yes. It was like a cross between Hugh Grant, a young Hugh Grant, and a young Paul McCartney with those sort of, downturned bedroom eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well,
he was a stunner.
We'll talk about him and your career at Morgan Stanley. This woman has had a fascinating life, ladies and gentlemen. It's not all horrible mommy stories. There are a lot of them because her mommy was horrible. But Rotten Kid is the title of the book, A Succulent Story of Survival. And if you're listening to her, you can tell that she has certainly survived and indeed thrived. We'll be back in a couple minutes. To get the full story of the life of Bridget Binns, you will have to buy Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival. She and I are just going to barely scratch the surface. I think we've done a pretty good job getting you getting away from home. You go to college eventually. Yes, Bridget?
I did. I went to Lewis and Clark College in Portland, which was a lovely place to be. And it was still on the West Coast, but it was far enough away from my mother that I felt safe.
With the intention of doing what? Once you escaped and went to college, high school is a different matter, but once you got to college, what did you aspire to do?
Well, I was one of those liberal arts flounderers.
Well, sure.
That
you and me both.
I thought, Yeah, right? I mean, I thought that I wanted to major in English lit, which is, I think, was the sort of refuge of those who didn't know what the heck they wanted to do. But along the way, I got really motivated by an overseas trip to Malaysia with the school. And I ended up changing my major to Chinese studies. And I spent years learning Mandarin and studying the culture and history of China. I just fell in love with that culture when I was in Malaysia, and that's what I ended up majoring in.
But then again, how does that lead to a job at Morgan Stanley?
Yes, well,
one of the great things about you and the book is the road you have traveled is to me full of surprises. There's, okay, you're majoring in Chinese, and then now you're going to be work for Morgan Stanley. I think it's wonderful that way. And it also tells me that you are open to everything that life has to offer.
I always have been. Yeah. And I think, you know, that may be one of the few benefits of being born to my mother, is that she taught me to be an adventurer.
And a survivor. And a survivor, I think. That's just my nickel and dime psychology speaking right
All I had was a Bachelor of Arts in Chinese Studies. And back in those days, you really needed a master's degree at least to get any kind of a decent job in China or the world that surrounded China. And I did not have that.
Yeah.
So I ended up going out on temping jobs while I was looking for a job in China. And I accidentally found myself at Morgan Stanley as a temp, and they offered me a real job. And at the same time, the World Council of Churches offered me a job in Hong Kong working in a refugee camp. And I wrote reams and reams of self-examination trying to figure out what to do, because I recognized that this was a huge fork in my life.
Sure.
And eventually I took the Morgan Stanley job because it just seemed more glamorous. And I realized that working in a refugee camp in Hong Kong was not going to help me climb any kind of ladder in a career in China. So I took the Morgan Stanley job, and the rest was history.
Let me ask you, during all this time, what was your relation? You do a wonderful job of detailing the early life of both of your parents, especially your father. I was very taken with that. What kind of relationship did you have with him as you grew up? Not much of one, yes?
Well, he wrote very breezy letters.
Yeah.
And, of course, I have most of them now. And that was it. He was traveling around the country performing in various regional theaters and doing movies and television. And he sent me very chatty letters, and I sent him letters back. And we didn't really see each other very much, especially after they started to split up and the anger became all-consuming between them, because I ended up in the middle, and I got stuck being the middleman between them, and it was a very uncomfortable place to be.
I can only imagine. There are such interesting things in this book, Bridget. At one chapter sort of starts with the unpredictable Hollywood lifestyle. You write, the unpredictable Hollywood lifestyle also came with some memorable episodes, like the time after the filming of Judgment at Nuremberg that William Shatner's toupee fell off while he was swimming in our pool during a lunch visit. I love the way in which I love the narrative of this book. I really, really do. It flits around. It moves all over the world. And we will pursue more about it if you'll sit and listen to the news in Chicago, Bridget, and then we'll carry on.
Thank you so much, Rick.
No,
it
is. It's fun for me, too. It's a fun. Right? There's some dark moments. I think I wrote something about your book. What did I say? I said Bridget Binns may have had a hard-drinking actor for a father and a mother of dangerous exuberance, but she is the star of her life story. This child of Hollywood writes with an observant honesty, telling of hard times and harrowing psychological troubles with surprising humor and heart. You will come away from this book with great admiration for her spirit and great affection for her. I'll try to reaffirm that after the news, so stay tuned. Welcome back. This, again, is Rick Kogan, and this show is After Hours, and I'm devoting this entire hour to a fascinating and wildly readable book titled Rotten Kid, A Succulent Story of Survival. It is the memoir. It is the memoir of a woman named Bridget Binns. Bridget spelled B-R-I-G-I-T and Binns, B-I-N-N-S. She has her own website, of course, because all good authors should have their own website, and it's BridgetBinns.com. There's so much in here, Bridget. I think, you know, it's stupid we don't have 5 hours, but we've got you at Morgan Stanley now, and I'm just going to you fall in love there with this very handsome and obviously slightly charismatic guy. And you wind up in Europe, yes?
Well, he was English, and so he worked in the London office of Morgan Stanley while I was working in the New York office. And I went over there, and I noticed him, and he noticed me, and then he wrangled a trip to the New York office a couple of weeks later. And yeah, I mean, it was very fast. I think we had spent maybe 2 weeks in each other's presence before he proposed to me on the island of Paros in Greece. And I ended up as an English housewife. I mean, who would have expected that?
Yeah, no, as I said, the road of your life is filled with fascinating twists and turns. Was it then that you began going to cooking school?
Yes, he didn't want me to work. I had been working in the back office at Morgan Stanley New York on settlements.
Yeah.
And he didn't want me to work in London, I think because he was afraid that he had enemies in the financial world that might be rough on me. But, you know, later on, I think maybe that's not the real reason.
Yeah, sure.
He didn't want me to work.
Exactly. Yeah, it seemed controlling. But that led you. You had had... I don't make too much of it, but you and your mother had it seems like some of the only calm, non-nasty times you may have had as a kid were involved food, did they not, or the kitchen?
I think the only love language that existed between she and I was food. When she made that first cheese souffle for me, I don't know what age I was, probably pretty little, and I realized the alchemy that you can create in the kitchen. It made a big impression on me. And I saw that when she cooked for people for dinner parties, at which I was, you know, the slave.
Yeah, of course.
That it made people happy. And that was the big thing for me. I was like, oh, look, you can make people happy by cooking for them.
And no, I can see that. Sure.
Yeah.
And so you dove into that. And that eventually led you into your writing career. But you wound up. Remind me of, did you and your husband break up when you guys were in Spain, or is that before?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, he had lost his job with Morgan Stanley in a very dramatic fashion, and it was traumatic as well. And he said that he could never work in the business again.
Oh boy.
And so I sold our house in London in 3 days and moved. We had been building this little tiny bungalow on the Costa del Sol in Spain, and we had nowhere else to go. So we went down there, and it wasn't even quite finished yet, and he didn't work. And so I thought, well, I'm trained, you know, as a cook.
Right.
I would never say chef, because
right,
chefs are the ones that work in restaurants. But I'm trained. I can be the provider. And so I started a catering business in southern Spain. A lot of my clients were either English or German or Scandinavian.
What town were you in? What town are you in the Costa del Sol?
What town? It's a little town called Estepona, which is about halfway between Gibraltar and Marbella.
You're going to die when you hear this.
What
year was that? What year was that?
I think I was there from 89 to 92.
Oh, I was there much before that. I lived there for a year. I lived in Estepona for a year when I decided to drop out of college and go be a writer, do my Hemingway thing. Yeah, I lived in Estepona for a year.
That blows my mind, Rick.
Mine too, dear. But I was, you know, Franco was still alive, and there were all these people who owned little restaurants there who just, you know, Brits and some Germans who owned tiny restaurants and had been waiting for 5 or 6 years for Franco to die and tourists to come. It was, and I was there, you know, some, I don't know, 10 years ago or something. It's a nice town. It's a nice, nice town. You and he split up.
Yeah, he was a cheater. Mm-hmm. He was a big cheater, and I was very naive because I, you know, for me, once somebody commits to me, after spending my childhood thinking that nobody would ever like me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I lose my sense of what's the word, of critical analysis.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, nothing bad is ever going to happen to me because this lovely man married me. And
yeah.
I was just so very wrong.
Wow. So then you eventually came back to the United States of America and California in particular, yes?
Well, I had a choice of three places to go. I had most recently lived in London and have and still have lots of friends there. But I didn't think that I wanted to be single in England because of the whole class system.
Mm-hmm.
Or before that, the place I had lived most recently in America was New York.
Right.
But it felt like a failure to go back there after my triumphant departure with the, you know, handsome English
exactly,
guy.
Yeah,
and
the
also.
Prince, yeah.
Yeah, the prince, and also the weather. And so in spite of the presence of my mother in Los Angeles, I chose Los Angeles. But I didn't intend to stay there. I thought, oh, I'll just stay for a bit and then go to either Santa Barbara or San Diego because they're more manageable communities. But I got a little sidetracked.
But you also, what I really admire about you, too, is you didn't go to, you know, Iowa Writers Workshop, but you've written some 30 books, cooking. You've sort of been a ghostwriter for a number of, maybe you could call them chefs. It's almost like you're a cottage industry when it comes to cookbooks.
I have, in recent years, I did start to feel like a recipe writing machine a little bit, but it was my dream, Rick. It was my, I was like the little kid standing outside the bakery, staring through the window at the croissant. I was just, the idea that I could write cookbooks would just, I never expected that it would work out. But I met certain women in Los Angeles when I arrived, and they helped me, and I also got a job ghostwriting a book for the very top chef in Los Angeles. And I had that cooking school under my belt, and I became very adept at writing like a German man for a while there because I did a lot of
stuff for Williams-Sonoma, yes?
I did 11 books for Williams-Sonoma, and that was, you know, that was a blessing. It may not have been the artistic pursuit that I had hoped for, but it paid bills, and I was writing cookbooks.
And you found that you were, you were obviously good at it. Again, I have not read any of Bridget Binz's cookbooks, and I'm frankly unlikely to because I'm so taken. I may reread Rotten Kid again, A Succulent Story of Survival. But you obviously are very artful, talented cooking writer. Is that what you call yourself? What do you call yourself?
Yeah, well, I call myself a cookbook author, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, my mother was still alive when I started writing cookbooks,
I
showed her some of my work, and she said, oh, this is trite and self-involved, and this is not writing. And I think part of the, maybe, to be honest, part of the reason I wanted to do the memoir is that I wanted to prove to myself that I could do something other than write recipes.
Yeah, yeah. Did you what sort of, and I have to believe you did, what sort of therapy have you undergone to try to, you know, not vanquish, but live with the ghosts? You have this epilogue is heartbreaking in the book. It's only two and a half pages long, but it's about you and your mom, and it almost brought me to tears. What kind of therapy or have you participated in to kind of deal with your folks?
Well, when I first arrived back in L.A. after 10 years in Europe, my mother suggested that we visit a therapist together.
Oh, my God.
And she said she wanted to figure out why her only daughter hated her.
Ugh.
And I said, sure, absolutely. I said, in fact, you go 6 times by yourself, and then I'll join you, and that way you can get the therapist on your side, which is silly because therapists are better than that. but that's what happened. And then after, you know, another 6 or 7 joint sessions, she was just crying all the time in the therapy because the therapist said your daughter felt like an employee who could be fired at any time.
Oh, wow.
And so I said, we don't need to do this anymore because it's upsetting for you. So she quit, and I kept going to the therapist, Kate, for another year, I guess. And that was when I realized that there was nothing I could ever have done to make her like me or make her believe in me.
This was
the elephant. That was the guy that had been sitting on my shoulders all that time. And doing the therapy allowed me to realize that I could let it go.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Well, the epilogue in here, the epilogue begins, I called in hospice care on Labor Day after my mother's primary doctor said to me, quote, she is in too much pain to stay at home. Either she goes to the hospital or you call in hospice. You are a sophisticated, mature woman. You know people die. How hard was that for you?
It was miserable.
Yeah.
But one of the last things she said to me was, my beautiful daughter, why did we waste so much time being angry with each other?
I'm looking at that sentence in your book right now.
But by that time, she was into the morphine, and it seemed like a rhetorical question, so I didn't answer it. But I thought, yes, why? Why indeed?
Yeah. Was it hard to lose her? Or was it a relief? And your life and the story is so interesting that I don't mean to probe beyond what you've put on the page, but how'd you feel?
It was a relief, and we're going to hark back to our mutual friend here for a moment, because during that week when the hospice had come in, Susan Das was in, I think, Egypt or somewhere on the opposite side of the planet, and she and I would talk and text on the phone while I was lying at the foot of my mother's bed with my hand on her leg.
Wow.
And she told me, Susan told me, that you should talk to her because it may not seem like it, but she can hear you, even though she seems like she's gone at this point.
Wow, that's good advice. Wow.
And it was wonderful. I mean, that's part of why I'm so close with Susan, is because she's been so supportive of me. She has always,
time,
sworn that when she gets upstairs, she's going to go looking for my mother and have some words.
If I'm up there, I could not be possibly be in the same room with Susan Bass and your mother. That would send me back somehow. It is a remarkable book. You now live in Paso Robles. You are now in what I understand, because I've met him. Somehow I've met your Casey. I've not met your dog. I don't remember. Casey was here for something. I don't know. But you seem very happy. And after your mom died, that's when you were able to sort of sit down and start the process of writing this amazing, Bridget Binns, it's an amazing book. It's an amazing amazing story.
You're very kind. I appreciate your words.
Don't be silly. How is it? How is it selling? Do you care? I mean, you must care a bit.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, hey, I'm only human. It's doing quite well. I've had some wonderful blurbs, some amazing reviews, and I'm happy, I guess, for now. But I'd like it to get out to a slightly wider audience.
Is it?
And
has it?
Well, and I recorded the audiobook, by the way.
Oh, good.
I narrated it. It was quite an experience.
I'll bet it was.
I got a little choked up there with my engineer right next to me.
I'm not surprised. Well, you live in a very nice place in California. And what's your dog's name? You have a dog?
Yes, I have two. I have Lucy, the Staffordshire Terrier, and Bosco, the Dachshund. And they are wonderful.
To have read this book and then talk to you and find that you are happy now makes me extraordinarily happy, Bridget Binns. It's quite a story, and it is a triumph. I really believe that. I know a lot of people who've had tough upbringings and did not make it out alive, as they say. So it's a pleasure to know you. It's been a pleasure to read you. I hope you keep writing other books other than cookbooks, because I'll be the first in line to buy them.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind words indeed, and I am working on a novel at the moment. So
as well you should be. I hope to meet you face-to-face sometime, Bridget. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
You are always welcome here in California.
Too many wildfires. Take care and say hi to Casey for me.
I shall, and say hi to Kate. You be well.
Will do. Thanks, dear. Bye.